You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Hour two coming at you here on the Mike Allen Show. On this, the day before Thanksgiving, November 23rd, I still recall a few years ago, I had the opportunity when I was a Methodist pastor. This is a number of years ago, I guess, 15 or so years ago. I was part of a group when I was a Methodist pastor of an interfaith Thanksgiving Eve service every year. I wonder if it's still going on, but it involved my little Methodist church, a Lutheran church, a Presbyterian church, a Disciples of Christ church, the local Catholic cathedral that was here in Lexington, actually where we broadcast from, and a Reformed Jewish synagogue. And so we would gather together. We would kind of switch around to the different houses of worship, and a different clergy person would preside over this, you know, sort of preach the sermon every year. And I remember I got assigned to it the year that it was going to be at the Jewish synagogue. Boy, little did I know, of course, that only a few years later it would be me becoming Catholic. And anyway, but there I was preaching in this Jewish synagogue. And I remember saying, I just thought, let's just call the elephant in the room. I said, my potential for offending somebody is really, really high. Just as it is, I guess, when I sit here on this microphone in the mornings. But I remember preaching in that sermon that day. I said, I got a secret for you. I said, you know, there are areas in which all of us here have different points of view. I said, but let me tell you a little secret. I think I'm right. Everybody kind of chuckled, you know, of course. But it kind of deflated the balloon a little bit, you know. And we talked about what real diversity is. It's not agreeing on everything. It's respecting one another, even when we disagree. And got a guy in here just walked into the studio who I disagree with a lot. And his name is Jason Hall, the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, practicing No Shave November, clearly. Too bad y'all can't see it here. Happy Thanksgiving Eve, Jason.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
We all have the right to be wrong, so you're free to disagree with me whenever you like.
Well, yes. I don't disagree with you about a lot, but some key things.
Such as?
No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, good to have you here.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
Yeah, I like the beard. Nice. A little salt and pepper in there.
Yeah, a lot of that. A little more salt than pepper, I think, these days. But yeah, I'm struggling with it a little bit. It's a little itchier than I anticipated.
Yeah, have you bought your Catholic beard balm yet?
No, but I'm getting some.
Really?
Yeah, I have to. I got to do something.
So you're going
to
smell like chrism?
Exactly. Smell like baptism.
The odor of sanctity?
Exactly.
I still want to market that as a Catholic cologne. I think that would really go over.
Yeah.
You'd have to spell it the odor of sanctity or something like that. Anyway, now welcome in and blessings to the Jessica. Your first Thanksgiving as a married couple?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you didn't have any arguments about where you were going to spend it or anything?
No, actually. No, she's with her work schedule and everything, it kind of, we only really ended up having one option, so it worked out well.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you, Jessica. And we're going to have Jessica on the program here pretty soon,
yeah.
So.
She's looking forward to it.
Have a little competition. That'll be good.
I already see the field.
Well, you know, let's do this for Jessica, because it's not a Friday, but practically speaking, it's a Friday, since I've got a short week this week, so we'll pray the Anima Christi together.
Sure.
All right. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Soul of Christ, sanctify me. Body of Christ, save me. Blood of Christ, inebriate me. Water from the side of Christ, wash me. Passion of Christ, strengthen me. O good Jesus, hear me. Within thy wounds, hide me. Separated from thee, let me never be. From the malignant enemy, defend me. In the hour of my death, call me, and bid me come to thee, that with thy saints I may praise thee forever and ever. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Amen. In the midst of all you have to be thankful for, be sure to remember those who are suffering, those, I think of those in Chattanooga, those families who are grieving.
Yes.
Just a terrible situation. I'd also ask for your prayers for my wife. She has pneumonia, but hopefully is on the mend from that. So pray for my wife, Angie, if you would. Jason, the last time you were on here, I was thinking about this. You know, it's been about a month. Since you were on here last, the Cubs have won the World Series. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump has won the presidency of the United States. So I'm going to ask you this. If we were to go back in time, a la Marty McFly in a DeLorean, 3 years ago, and if I'd asked you which one of those scenarios was more likely, which would you have said?
Well, certainly the Cubs winning the World Series, absolutely.
You would have said was more likely.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, well, even 3 years ago, I mean, Theo Epstein was already at work, you know, and he's
right
more than capable of building a winning baseball team. I don't know. I would not have thought that Donald Trump being elected president was at all likely.
So, election day, I mean, did you just pretty much assume it was, I mean, you know, here Nate Silver was saying, I think by the time the results started rolling in, Nate Silver, 538, who is seen as the statistical savant, you know, he was saying that Hillary Clinton had a 78% chance of winning the election.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people agreed
with
that.
Most people disagreed. They took a lot of heat because most people felt he gave giving Trump more than a 1 in 5 chance was way too much of a chance.
Oh, wow.
I read 538 almost every day, and they for weeks published articles like, look, today Trump has a 28% chance to win. That's a 28% chance. So, and what they were saying was, is that not that they predicted, I mean, they still, you know, Hillary, they had Hillary as the favorite, but they, you know, what they kept saying, I think very accurately, was that the election had a lot of uncertainty. And so their model that they built accounted for that uncertainty, but they were by far gave Trump the highest chances to win of any mainstream prediction model. And just to give you an example, in 2012, Mitt Romney, I think a week before the election, had a 9% chance to win. And so they were giving Trump more than a 20% chance to win, which is a more than 1 in 5 chance to win. And they you know, I have to say, they published a lot of articles about how that was a real chance to win. Not the most likely scenario, but a real chance to win. And what was interesting is a full third of his chances to win involved him winning the Electoral College while losing the popular vote.
Wow, yeah.
So I think they actually, to be fair to them, actually did a pretty good job of seeing the possibility of what happened.
So you don't think 538 has lost any credibility?
Oh, no. I think they were the only ones who were even talking about that. And they were getting a lot of heat from some of the other prediction folks, like with other models, saying, you know, that, no, that's ridiculous. You haven't had a single poll outside of this one outlier that's had Trump ahead for weeks and blah, 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 blah. And it's just extremely unlikely that he could win. They kept saying, no, there's all these undecided voters, more than usual. There's this, there's that. There's the he has a real potential path in the Electoral College, even if he loses the popular. And they kept saying those things. And that's exactly what happened. So to me, that tells me they saw this. They may have gotten, whether they got the probability wrong, we'll never know. We'd have to run the election in a real world 1,000 times to see, but you only get to do it once. But they certainly talked a lot about the possibility of what happened happening. So,
do you think the credibility of polling has taken a hit after this?
Well, I've been, you know, polling, and Nate has written about this too, actually. But polling has been having a little bit of a rough time lately anyway. They missed by about 2 points, which is considered the popular vote by about 2 points, which is about a normal polling error.
Right.
It's not unusual to be off by a couple points, the polling average. You know, they missed Brexit by more than that, for example. They missed the 2012 election by more than that. A lot of people don't know that. The polling average the day before the election underestimated Barack Obama's margin by 3 points.
Mm.
So they didn't get the quote-unquote winner wrong, but they got the popular vote wrong by a larger margin in 2012 than they did in 2016. So polling, I think there's a general understanding that it's becoming harder to do because reaching people is harder. People are less likely to answer questions. It's harder to get a sample. You have to do more adjusting, which creates more possibility for error. But did this election, like, was it the break? Was it some out, you know, just unbelievable miss? No, it wasn't. It was pretty normal, actually.
So you're a political junkie. I mean, I'm sure you did you sit in front of the television and watch all the results come in?
I did, yes, until pretty late.
Were you like me in that when you saw Trump outperforming his poll numbers, say, in Virginia, you know, where he, of course, he ultimately lost Virginia, but it was very close, and people thought that was a Clinton lock. Did that was that your first sense that maybe something's happening here, or did it happen a little bit later?
I thought it was pretty clear pretty early, and I felt that Trump was going to do better than people thought he was going to do. You know, whether that would result in a win, it was hard to say. But I thought, like, I mean, by 10, 11 o'clock, it was like, this could really, you know, I mean, I don't remember. I'm guessing on the time. I can't remember exactly what time it was, but pretty early in the night, maybe 9:30 even. It was, this is, you know, closer. And one of the things I thought was funny is I've always had, you know, cable in the past, and I would watch, you know, Fox News or whatever. But I'd heard about how bad network news coverage of election night was, but I'd never watched it before. And I was watching CBS, and when they called Ohio for Trump, like, by this point, it's like Trump has probably going to win this thing. And their way of reporting, and on Twitter, and everybody was talking about that. But see, the CBS's reaction to calling Ohio for Trump was, well, this keeps his hopes alive for the White. Keeps his hopes alive. He's winning the election.
Wow. We'll be back with more with Jason Hall. We're going to actually talk a little bit about conscience, try to correct some misconceptions maybe and walk through it together. We'll be back on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. If you've got a comment or question, 573-4BREAD-4.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Okay, minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here with my good friend in the house, Jason Hall. Jason Hall, who's the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky and a regular guest on the program. We're talking a little bit about the election, though certainly the Cubs winning is a big story.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't had a chance to talk about that, I don't think, since we, in the last several years.
And now I'm seeing today that some people are saying a lockout could be on the table. I mean, does baseball not learn a single lesson? I mean, here you've got Cubs-Indians, 7-game World Series. I mean, just when they, you know, you're starting to get the magic back. Is that really going to happen? I mean, come on.
I don't think so. I think they have learned, or at least they did learn their lesson for a long time. Now, eventually lessons get forgotten, I guess. Generations
That's
change.
True.
But, I mean, we have had, since 94, there have been probably 4 or 5 contract negotiations that resulted in no labor stoppage whatsoever, which was probably unprecedented, almost unprecedented. So I think they did learn their lesson in that sense, but who knows? What's interesting is I think the players have really not done well in the contract negotiations over the last several cycles, so you know, baseball's revenue is way, way up, and players' salaries have not kept pace. So, who knows? I don't know. There might be.
Is Theo Epstein the greatest general manager in the history of baseball?
That's a tie. No, not prepared to answer that question.
I mean, that's unbelievable. Red Sox, Cubs.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, he's kind of he's the kind of general manager I like. I mean, in the sense that he doesn't get into this silly, you know, there's one right way to do it kind of thing. He takes all the information he's got. I mean, he's known as kind of a sabermetrics-friendly manager or general manager, which is true. He certainly uses that, but it's not like he's, you know, he cares about those various debates. He just wants all the information, anything he can use to evaluate players, and he does a good job at it and in sorting that information. So yes, he brought analytics and all that into the Red Sox front office and then into Chicago's front office. But, you know, of course, that was always more a debate among fans anyway than
sure.
about the stats versus scout stuff. I mean, nobody really, no front officers were like, we don't want that information or any kind of, you know.
I wonder if Theo likes Skyline Chili. Maybe we could get him down to Cincinnati.
Yeah, or even maybe a protege of his or something.
You want to challenge Theo? Come on. Come on down to Great American.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Anyway, I know you've got your catechism open and you're loaded for bear, ready to talk about.
Well, I was looking. I hadn't had a chance to do as much prep as I'd hoped. But
oh, wow. Because the expectation is that you poured over material before you came in here. So,
well, I planned to last night, but then I decided not to. So, so you understand.
I understand. Believe me. Believe me, I understand. Anyway, we're going to talk about conscience here in a minute. We don't necessarily have to be in a rush. But one of the things that I was very clear, you know, I wasn't going to vote for either major party candidate in the election. And, you know, of course, I have friends now who like to call me out and stuff on social media, and that's okay. But, you know, that because I didn't vote for either candidate, I somehow, whatever. But here's the thing that has been amazing to me. And now we're seeing signs of Trump softening some of the things that he said, you know. And so those who say, well, we took him seriously but not literally, you know, they're saying here's the evidence, which is odd to me why you vote for a candidate that you assume is going to have lied to you. But set that aside for a minute. It's the swiftness from which Donald Trump went in the eyes of some that I know who voted for him, who allegedly did so with a held nose as the lesser of evils. And, you know,
he's
a terrible candidate,
but
he became all of a sudden an unmitigated good.
Mm-hmm.
So that everything he does, we have to defend.
You can't criticize the president-elect.
Give him a chance, you know, which is odd to me.
Mm-hmm.
It either means that they were disingenuous before the election, right, and they really were approving of Trump, or somehow they think that, you know, it's not right to criticize the person elected, which certainly they didn't observe the previous 8 years. So anyway.
Yeah, I think, you know, I can just add to that. I think that there is a little bit of, I mean, I think it is fair to say, like, you know, I've been laying off the criticism of Trump the last,
right.
I mean, in a sense of, okay, there's no ability to change anything now. You're
right.
Not persuading people. You're not, decisions aren't, there is a sense in which, okay, give the guy's got his chance. I mean, nobody's going to take the chance away. He's going to be the president. He gets to set up his administration. He gets to set an agenda. And so in that sense, we are all giving him a chance, and we're going to judge it based on what happens. And I do think you got to give him a little room for that, but and wait and see what happens. You know, but at the same time, I think there's this temptation to be on a side. And during the election, you can be on that. It's really clear cut. Like, you know, it's Hillary versus Trump, and people want to be on one side and they want to attack the other side. And once the election's over, it's a little harder. You know, it's like you're either with the president or not. And there's not a, it seems to, it doesn't have to be that way. To me, that's kind of silly. Now it's like, well, the election's over. We can all sit back and criticize where it's warranted and, you know, and praise him where warranted. Whereas, you know, some people feel like, you know, it's hard to come down off of the election high. Maybe that's the way to think about it, is that we've been in this, you know, two-sided argument
right.
for so long that maybe it's hard to just step back and be like, well, he is our president for the next 4 years. It's going to be 2.5 before even the next presidential election starts to happen again. So why do we have to be 100% one side or the other at this point? But
so
I was rambling a little bit too.
No, there are of course signs in some of his public comments, you know, that he's backing off. I mean, this is the art of the deal. The, you know, you come out strong and then you back off of your position, right? So he's sort of welshing a bit on the whole climate change thing. You know, is maybe there's some human element there. you know, some other things, that whether he's going to pursue any sort of, I mean, he's made it clear now, no investigation of the Clintons. You know, he doesn't want to hurt them.
Which, you know, by the way, if I can just say about that, I have no, like, I take a backseat to no man in my conviction that the Clintons are corrupt to the core, okay? I mean, they've been, whatever, I don't want to go there. But at the same time, that is a longstanding American truth. We don't go after defeated political opponents.
Right.
And whether or not he should pardon Clinton, I don't know about that. But I mean, we, like, going on some vendetta against a defeated political family that's not even likely to ever come back, you know, unless right. it's the next generation, is kind of, it'd be a waste of time and political capital and all that too. So,
well, you saw a similar thing when, he didn't defeat him directly, but President Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush, there was a lot of talk about going after Cheney and Bush for war crimes and all this kind of mm-hmm. stuff because of torture. And of course, that was after the election was over, shelved, right? But the other thing he's also now said, he has disavowed, he's condemned, in those words, the alt-right, you know, which is a subset of people that I don't mm-hmm. think most people even knew anything about until really almost after the election, most people. Then all of a sudden, kept hearing about this movement, the alt-right, and, you know, their white nationalist supremacist sort of mindset and stuff. And for whatever reason, have seen in Trump, you know, they've identified with him, supported him, whatever. He has now come out and publicly condemned them.
Well, he's condemned elements in the alt-right.
Elements, right.
Which to me is, it's laudable that you condemn, but it's kind of like condemning. I mean, seems to me to be a tricky line to draw. There are those Steve Bannon, who's going to be the chief strategist in the White House, you know, is a self-identified member of the alt-right. And he, so in that sense, he's not condemning the whole alt-right. He's bringing them into his administration. But
right.
he's trying to say the more extreme racial elements are not welcome. We don't consider that an essential part of the alt-right, and we want those to fall away and be excluded. I think the question a lot of people have is that possible? It's certainly the question I have, and maybe they're right, but I, based on what I've seen, it seems that, you know, the identity of European Americans, kind of, you know, white nationalism mm-hmm. is more of a core tenet of the alt-right
right.
than something, some weird idea held by some fringe members of the alt-right. But,
well, when you have somebody wrong. Who's, you know, associated with your administration going on, I think it was with Megyn Kelly, and, you know, talking about a Muslim registry being constitutionally justifiable, and you cite the internment camps of the Japanese.
Yeah, we have precedent. We have precedent for internment camps in the United States. I mean,
if you're wanting to quell concern, that's not the way to do it.
Exactly. And you know, and I think, too, like, there's this idea, like, okay, Steve Bannon, and I don't want to go all down the Bannon rabbit hole by any means, but he stated, I want to make Breitbart, his website he used to run, I want to make it a platform for the alt-right.
Right.
But yet now it's, and he was publisher and editor for a long time of that, and now it's somehow considered illegitimate to look at, well, what did he publish during his time of making Breitbart a platform for the alt-right? And doing that does not exactly make you feel better
right.
about what his view of legitimate alt-right opinion is, in my opinion, anyway. But a lot of people think that's illegit. You publish stuff you don't agree with necessarily, so.
Well, we got to go to break. When we come back, we're going to get into this issue of conscience and how we understand it, conscience and religious liberty, why it matters. Here with my good friend Jason Hall, this is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. here on this Thanksgiving Eve edition. Short week this week. And pleased to have in the studio my good friend Jason Hall of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, Executive Director and guest of the show since the beginning. 7 years now, Jason. We're almost completing. Can you believe that?
Feels like 30. I mean, it feels like we just started.
It's like the 7 years of tribulation.
No comment.
You're just hoping to be, you weren't raptured before it. Anyway, great to have you here. If you've got a question or a comment for Jason, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. I am asking a question of the day is Bruce Hornsby's birthday. Who's your favorite rock and roll or pop piano player? Pianist. Hmm. My children tell me I always need to enunciate that very clearly. A pianist. So, but I had a question the day earlier this week. I thought it was World Television Day the other day.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I saw it too late to comment before your show.
But. So, what show have you watched the most episodes of any of your whole in your whole life?
I guess it'd probably be Seinfeld because I've watched there are 9 seasons and I've watched that through multiple times. So, I would say probably Seinfeld.
Yeah, and in terms of science, I was thinking about this the other day. The best shows.
Although, unless you count the Star Trek franchise as one whole.
Oh, then it could be competition.
But that's multiple series. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, the Seinfeld, I think the quality is in the middle years as opposed to on the outer years, in my opinion.
I think it's a show that didn't hit its stride, really. Until season 3 or 4.
Right.
But I think it was pretty consistently good to the end.
I'd say I think once Larry David left, they went down a little bit.
Well, maybe a little bit. But I think it's, like, I think seasons 8 and 9 are very good. But
I even like the final episode, which some people don't, but I liked it.
Well, I like the episode. Like, when I think of the final season, I think of that one where Kramer has the girlfriend downtown, you know, and he's wearing the I Love New York shirts. And he's like, Jerry, I'm at the corner of First and First, the nexus of the universe.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
So, yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good stuff.
Anyway, we were talking on the phone a little bit yesterday about this issue of conscience. And we talked about this some the last time you were on the program leading up to the election. But you think this whole process, both leading up to the election and in the aftermath, has revealed a lot of misunderstandings about conscience from a Catholic perspective.
Mm-hmm. I really do think that. I think that's worth talking about, you know, now that the election is behind us and hopefully people are, you know, taking a breath and stepping back and thinking about things, you know, maybe a little more deeply. You know, conscience, and I just want to read, this is the starting in paragraph 1776, there's a long section on moral conscience.
Very patriotic. We're starting with 1776, by the way.
The year The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was published.
Oh, there you go.
Among other things. But no, the first paragraph, I'll just read the first paragraph. It says, deep within his conscience, man discovers a law which he has not laid upon himself, but which he must obey. Its voice, ever calling him to love and to do what is good and to avoid evil, sounds in his heart at the right moment. For man has in his heart a law inscribed by God. His conscience is man's most secret core and his sanctuary. There he is alone with God, whose voice echoes in his depths.
And that's now, taken from, by the way, Gaudium et Spes.
From the Second Vatican Council. Mm-hmm. And what I think I want to highlight with this is the church understands conscience to be that law written on the heart that St. Paul talks about, and also that we all have. There are certain things we can't really not know.
Mm-hmm.
And then also beyond that, it is also that fundamental connection that every human person has with his or her creator. And it is that voice of God in their heart. So the church acknowledges that every single person has that and is born with it. Every single conscience can be fed and nourished and formed. It can also be malformed, misformed, silenced. All of those things are true. And so it is important to nourish and help form our consciences, because sin can have a distorting effect, particularly habitual sin or, you know, repetitive grave sin can dull our conscience. There's no question about that. But it is also true that the church understands that a person who honestly believes their conscience is calling them to do a particular thing or to abstain from a particular thing, that person is morally bound before God to follow their conscience. That's we're judged based on whether or not we followed our conscience. That's what we will be judged about. So I heard a lot. The reason I bring this up in relation to the election is you heard a lot in the election about voting one's conscience. But even more than that, and a lot of people kind of dismissing that, a lot of Catholics dismissing the idea that you couldn't vote for this candidate or another in good conscience and not really respecting that someone may feel that way, even if they themselves don't. But also, we had this big fight during the Obama years about the contraceptive mandate.
Right.
And that was about rights of conscience. And I know a lot of people that were kind of with us, with the church in that fight, you know, trying to get greater legal protections for conscientious objectors when it came to mandating, you know, paying for contraception and abortifacients. Now, a lot of those same folks are not worried about some things that were proposed by candidates in this election that were hostile to conscience. And they felt, you know, they would just dismiss it and say, well, a properly formed conscience or something, meaning that if I don't agree with you, your conscience is not properly formed. Therefore, your conscience has no rights.
Right.
That is not what the church teaches at all. The church consciences do need to be properly formed to operate at their optimum intended for their optimal intended purpose, but that does not mean that therefore we can judge another person's conscience to the point of not respecting it, or that therefore we don't need rights of conscience because we're in charge now, or something to that effect. And I think there's a little bit of temptation to that, and also I think, you know, that comes into with religious freedom, the idea that, well, religious freedom is about Catholic or Christian power or something like that. No, it's not. It's about respecting the right of conscience of a person to worship God according to the dictates of their conscience, to use a phrase that's very common in the American founding and a lot of state constitutions. Also, to live one's life according to whatever moral code that one's faith teaches, you know, that is a right of conscience that people have. You can't give absolute, you know, not everybody can have absolute unlimited, right? But we've had a long tradition in this country. At least we've striven, not always lived up to, but striven
right.
to allow for as much room for that as absolutely possible. And
so the irony,
really,
of course, on that is, you know, we go to the mat for the Little Sisters of the Poor and their rights of conscience, and for Christian bakers and so forth. But when it comes to having to, to ban Muslim immigration or to
set up a registry.
We don't have a problem with that.
We don't have a problem with that. Or when a particular presidential candidate, let's say, were to say that he doesn't believe members of the military should have a right to conscientiously object to orders that they believe are immoral. Now, in some cases, you know, that's true. I mean, in some, we would concede that, yes, militaries have to function, and you know, if there's a soldier in a particular place who receives an order and nobody else can carry it out, and that's the way, then that's, but we have always, as much as possible, allowed for conscientious objection in our military, and, you know, and especially when what was being talked about during the campaign was torture, which the Catholic Church teaches is intrinsically evil. And, you know, that it was said that, well, we're not going to allow conscientious objection of Catholic soldiers to not torture people. And a lot of folks are just dismissive, I found, of that as a concern.
While at the same time, having argued for years about the conscience rights of military chaplains, let's say, to not perform certain marriage ceremonies. So what it devolves down to is not so much about conscience, it's about power.
It's about power. And I think that's really the key, is that, you know, a lot of the saints talk about, you know, detachment. And I think that's often misunderstood. You know, we're not detached from the objects of proper love, like we're not detached from our families or other our duties. But what it means is we don't have inordinate attachments to worldly things that distract us from love. And so I think that's the problem. That's the temptation of politics, is to become attached to a particular agenda or party or candidate. And this is where detachment is so important, because maintaining our consistent prophetic voice on matters like protecting the rights of conscience is absolutely critical. And if we can't do that, then I'm not even sure what Catholics have to offer our political discourse in this country. And so I think we need to just be very careful. I think it's, now that the election's over, it's important for us to think about these things and understand that, you know, we have to be willing to kind of hold the line on certain things, no matter who's in power. And conscience is very much one of those.
Absolutely. If you've got a comment or a question, here with Jason Hall, the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. When we come back in a minute, Jason, I want to ask you a question. I was thinking, I talked to you a little bit about this last night, of whether you think the extreme partisanship and this tendency we have to either gravitate toward blind loyalty or blind hatred of political figures, whether that's actually playing into the executive branch's hand into accruing more and more power. So we'll talk about that when we come back for the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. This is Breadbox Media. We'd love to just stick around for a few minutes. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
It's before the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here with my good friend on Thanksgiving Eve, Jason Hall, Executive Director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky. You know, one of the things, and again, not everybody's obviously a Kentuckian, but you used to work in Frankfort. I mean, you still do, but you used to work for one part or the other and kind of the halls of Frankfort. Are you surprised that the Kentucky House went Republican?
Well, a couple things about that. One, in the big picture, no, I'm not surprised it eventually went Republican. I mean, Kentucky's been trending Republican a long time. I think there was a sense in which it was almost a matter of time. I think what's a surprise is that they've tried for a few cycles now to kind of get over that hump and fallen just short. And even in some special elections last year, fell just a little short. And kind of been in, you know, out of 100 seats, been in the high, mid to high 40s back and forth for a long time. And then to win such a huge, I mean, like, you know, everybody thought they had a shot, you know, like to get over 50, but they got 64 seats. And that's, so now they went from literally not quite being able to get there to having a super majority in one fell swoop. So I think in that sense, it was a surprise how it happened.
So now you've got in the state of Kentucky, a Republican governor, Republican House, and a Republican Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Nationally, I just thought this was fascinating because so many people were writing the, you know, eulogy for the Republican Party going into this presidential election, you know, that maybe the Democrats can take the House. You're going to have a Democratic president perhaps for another 8 years after we've already had one for 8 years. And then who knows, maybe Michelle Obama after that, you know. And all of a sudden, now people are writing epitaphs for the Democrats. I mean,
they don't have any young leader, all that kind of stuff. Well, go ahead.
It's breathtaking how quickly it changed.
Well, and I think part of that is just silly. I mean, people, wishful thinking on certain people's parts, both sides probably. But this whole Republican Party is dying. I mean, that in part shows the fact that all people really pay attention to is the presidential election, you know, who the president is. But it's also just a lot of lack, just ignorance about who controls what and how successful the two parties have been in elections. I mean, President Obama's been president for 8 years, but the Democratic Party has lost tons of ground at every other level of government during those 8 years. And, you know, I think just to give you an example, you know, the Kentucky House of Representatives, as you mentioned, went Republican this election for the first time in early 1920s. There'll be a Republican Speaker of the House in January. That is the last that the Democrats in the House, they were until will be until the end of this month or in the December, excuse me. The last Democratic-controlled legislative chamber in the entire southern United States.
Wow.
Okay. So they just lost their last one. So, I mean, and that's true. They control the vast majority of state legislatures. They have, I believe, now 33 of 50 governors. And that's both houses of Congress. In fact, I read that the Republicans are actually one legislature away from being able to ratify a constitutional amendment without a single Democratic vote. So, yeah, I think this whole the Republican Party is dead stuff has been crazy for a long time.
Well, how do you explain that, though, that trend when we look at demographics and how, you know, this country is becoming more, I mean, you know, it's predicted by whatever year, you know, that that white Americans, for example, will be no longer be the majority population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, minority populations tend to trend Democratic. So, I mean, how do you explain?
Well, I think when you get locally, the more local you get, the more that breaks down. So when you talk about state legislative races, you have less of a demographic split than you do in national politics. That's part of it. But the other part of it is that, yes, minorities have been gaining as a share of the population, but not at quite the rate that white Americans have been moving Republican. Mm. And so they, you know, white Americans are voting Republican in many states, extreme margins, voting margins, you know. So, you know, that may eventually recede. I mean, the Republican tide may eventually recede simply because of demographics, but it's not like, well, this is it. The next election, it's all falling apart. It's going to be kind of a gradual long-term thing. And, of course, over time, parties adapt and they find ways to reach new voters and that sort of thing, too. So,
is it a fair thing for, you know, people of color in this country? I mean, we saw Van Jones on CNN in a very tearful, eloquent, you know, we say, oh, this is a white lash. I mean, is that a fair perception?
Well, it's probably fair for certain segments. I mean, I think, you know, any broad generalizations are very difficult, but I mean, certainly, I think to deny that there's any racial element on the part of any significant group of voters would be wrong. I think there clearly is by some, but whether it all constitutes, I don't think so. I think it constitutes, you know, a lot of things. A lot of economic anxiety is part of this. A lot of, you know, just social conservatism. I think, you know, people underestimate, you know, the Democratic Party's leftward move on social issues and kind of becoming the party that doesn't seem to care or seems to even be hostile to those who are uneducated, those mm-hmm. who, you know, gun owners, whatever, you however you want to categorize people. That's had a lot to do with pushing white America into the Republican camp too, I think. I think it's all part, you know, all of those, it's all of the above. It's not a one or the other.
What about, you know, like Ross Douthat's claim, you know, the Samantha Bee phenomenon or whatever, that you know, the left is sort of in its own echo chamber. They overestimate,
there's no question about that,
you know, where the country has gone.
Well, and part of that too is, you know, if you look at the this election, I mean, you know, and we don't want to debate the Electoral College, but I mean, the truth is, like, Hillary Clinton, you know, her quote unquote win in the popular vote, which she did, she got more votes than Donald Trump. But that's because she really, in the major cities on the two coasts, she really ran up the score.
Right.
And in between, it was all Trump. And I think, you know, an Electoral College favors the candidate with the broader geographic appeal. That's what it's designed to do. Is to keep somebody from running up the score in one part of the country. But
does it make less sense to talk about red state, blue state than it does urban versus rural?
Yeah, I think urban versus rural is part of it. I mean, because Clinton did do well in, you know, Chicago. She did well in Philadelphia, but at the same time, not nearly as well as
right.
President Obama did. And that had she done as well in Detroit and Philadelphia and places like that as President Obama did, she would be the president. But But my point is, I think that, yes, there's that New York, Boston, Washington, L.A., San Francisco kind of bubble to, you know, which is, it's not just geographic by any means, but it's exacerbated by the fact that there is a geographic component to it.
Well, I do want to get to Dial of Catechism, but in less than a minute, can you tell me whether my argument about this tendency toward either blind loyalty or blind hatred plays into increasing executive power, because there's no one in your camp who's checking you.
There's no one in your camp that's checking you, and there is everybody in the other camp is attacking you for everything. So it literally doesn't, you can do anything, the attacks are going to be just as severe. So, yeah.
So we're bringing it on ourselves. We're ripe, perhaps, for, well, maybe not despotism, but certainly executive creep, for sure. All right, let's spin the Dial of Catechism wheel. 2468. I don't think that's the paragraph that
we will not read on the air.
Right. Not because we don't agree with it. Doesn't work for
family. It's not. 2468.
Yes, go ahead.
This is under the eighth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor about living in the truth. And it says, truth as uprightness in human action and speech is called truthfulness, sincerity, or candor. Truth or truthfulness is the virtue which consists in showing oneself true in deeds and truthful in words, and in guarding against duplicity, dissimulation, and hypocrisy.
Very good. So truthfulness, not Stephen
not
Colbert's that he coined, right?
Indeed.
Truth. All right. So, you know, when we think about, as with all the commandments, it's not just about following a particular rule. It's about a whole spirit, you know, the depth of virtue of what it means to be a truthful person, right, in our conduct. And again, we've been talking about politics. I mean, does anybody really care about truth anymore?
Well, I think, you know, as you're each of the commandments points to like an ultimate good, right? I mean,
right.
A good that is ultimately God, of course, the good, the true, and the beautiful, but. So you have all of these lesser offenses in it, but yeah, I think truth is a hard one for more people than maybe we like to admit it, because you know, there's a cost to truly living in the truth. But maybe that's always been the case, but I mean, it's certainly, I think, a lot of temptation to not live in the truth in one way or another.
There's a freedom, of course, in truth. But, you know, it's kind of like, as we've been talking about it with this, you know, election, it, you know, I keep hearing, well, take him seriously, but not literally, you know, just to go ahead and assume he's not telling the truth. And this is just kind of what we've come to expect. I mean, from our leaders, from.
And I think it's important, yeah, in that context, to understand that truth does not mean naivete. It
right.
means a sober viewpoint of the way things really are and living in light of the way things really are. And that includes not just the harsh realities of the world, but also the truth of our faith.
Well, the truth is, Jason, I appreciate you and your friendship and your presence on this show. And now you've added a better half. So happy Thanksgiving to Jessica.
I'm glad you got
you.
Another guest out of all that.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, listen, it's all good. Happy
well,
Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you, Mike. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right. And beginning of Advent. We'll be back Monday, by God's grace. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.